You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy. That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Hi, everybody. It is 10 p.m., you know what? Let me turn this off just to be on safe side. There we are. How are you? Hi, everyone. It's 10 p.m. It is the 15th of January, 2022, 10 p.m. East Coast time anyway. My name is Luke Thomas. I am one half of Morning Combat. This is our UFC Vegas 46 post-fight show. I will do this for about 45 minutes or so. I should have put it up on this one. I didn't think to do it. I have a tweet up. It's not at this one. It's at L Thomas News. You can put a question in there. We'll get to it at the end of the program. And yeah, we'll talk about the main event. There's not a whole lot to get to beyond the main event, quite candidly, but actually a lot to talk about in that main event. Just a remarkable one to start the year off. UFC's first main event of the year. Very, very good. And Michael Bisping had a word for it. Inspirational was one of the things he says. I don't think that's an exaggeration or wrong. I quite agree with him. A lot to say. So, thumbs up on the video, please. I'm assuming there's sound. Jesus Christ, if there's not, well, then there's not. Thumbs up on the video. Hit subscribe if you are new here. Yes? Or if you've been around and you've not subscribed at this point, do me a solid. Throw me a subscribe. Yeah? Okay. With that out of the way, let's talk about it. Let me pull the results up here. Okay. And by the way, I'm assuming if you're watching this, you don't mind that there are spoilers or whatever the fuck at this point. Okay. Okay, so if you don't want spoilers now, it's time to go. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Okay. All right. This was UFC, whatever you want to call it, Fight Night, Cater versus Chikadze, UFC Vegas 46, UFC, whatever, whatever. Took place at the Apex facility, quite obviously, and Calvin Cater defeats Giga Chikadze 50-45, 50-45, 50-44, and frankly, I'm not sure that that's wrong. I wasn't scoring in real time, so I can't exactly co-sign on it, but when I first heard it, I was a little bit surprised, but then I was like, no, not necessarily. Especially the way, like the truly dominant ending. It had a little bit of that Adesanya Gastelum vibe of think the fifth round of that contest when he really began to take over, nearly secured the finish. It was something cut close to that. Whether it's 50-45 or 50-44 is really not the point. Actually, the point is much different than that, which is, I have to tell you, this is one of the, the sport is just constantly remarkable, man. It's constantly remarkable. That's really, you know, a lot of people fall in and out of love with you, and also with MMA, but you know what I'm saying? Like, they have these real, like, passionate relationships with MMA, and then they kind of burn out on them, and I'm always like, man, if you just stick around and just kind of ride it out, you begin to realize that you have not seen it all. It is relentlessly surprising. It is not that I thought that Calvin Cater's career was somehow done or something like that. I don't mean to suggest that. But obviously, I don't think it's irrational or wrong to have, at a mere minimum, curiosity about how he's going to look subsequent to, dude, one of the most historic beatings I've ever seen. Now, I mean, I've seen people injured worse than that, so it's not the worst beating in that sense where it was like the most gruesome, but certainly one of the more prolonged ones. I mean, it was a show. Whether you want to say you've seen someone get hurt more in the process, perhaps, but certainly we can all agree in UFC history, it's a bad one. It's a really bad one. And you know, Chael Sonnen was the one who has really been actually, I think, pretty correct and steady about reminding people. It's not just that people get injured more in a 5-round versus a 3-round. Quite obviously, there's 2 more rounds, right? You're going to get more. But that the rate of injury is like exponential in those championship round moments. Now, to what extent that's been measured and verified, I don't know. But the outcomes certainly feel that way after the fact, right? Like, I mean, that was fucking brutal. First of all, Calvin Kattar's broken his nose a million times. Looks like, and I've had him on my various shows through the years, and I've talked to him. Like, he's talked about all the flights he's been on where his nose has been broken, and like all the pressure from, you know, changing atmospheres has fucked him up, and how awful it is, and, you know, having to breathe through like a KN95 mask the whole time through your mouth when you can't. It's just, you know, it can be a nightmare. Looked like he broke it again, which I was just like, oh, poor guy, man. Fuck, that's going to be another shitty flight home. You know what I mean? Breathing through your mouth. And then Giga Chikadze, dude, what can you say? Gee, Lord have mercy. These guys continue to impress me, dude. I'm telling you, man, just when you think like the bar of what is just so routine at this point and what is so excellent is so high. Again, we've had this conversation a million times. I understand MMA fatigue. I certainly understand MMA overload. But when you just kind of learn to surf at a steady medium like I've done, you just begin to realize that, like, you know, at that, in the way in which I am consuming it, you just see just these routine demonstrations of excellence. Excellence in what? Certainly occupational specialties, jiu-jitsu and kickboxing. You saw a little bit of that tonight in certain respects. But in Giga Chikadze's case, which is what we're talking about here, that dude is, I mean, I really hate the fuck. Me and my team, we're built different. Like, yes, you know. I bet you're different in all kinds of ways. I really don't like it. But then, you know, it is sort of to the point, right? It's like intent. It's, you know, marketing has turned into this sort of like ambiguous catch-all kind of fun statement of, you know, excellence and defiance and a few other things. But, some of these guys at the world-class level, I just don't think folks understand. Let me explain something. In the Holloway fight with Kattar, you'll get people who walk into a gym and begin to spar at some point, whether early or middle or late, within, let's say, a 9 month to a year long period. They'll take 1% of 1% of one. I mean, a 1% of nothing, right? To the nth degree of what Kattar took in that fight with Holloway, and they'll go out of the gym and you'll never see him again. This is routine. Like, when you look at the spectrum of what tough looks like, you know, this is what I mean, man. I've audited it, man. You know, have you ever really truly audited how tough you are? Like, truly ever audited it? You know, I've tried and, you know, I'm not going to get the highest remarks out there. So that's reserved for folks like Giga Chikadze. Didn't get the worst scores, you know, somewhere in a happy medium. But I at least know, man. I know what the difference is between some of these groups, man. I've seen it. I've lived it, you know, and there's been some sorting that has happened, you know, and you can, it's unmistakable when it happens. Dude, Giga Chikadze is fucking built different, man. That dude is tough as shit. And Calvin Kattar is too. He is tough physically. He is tough mentally. Dude, both of those guys, that was just a declaration of grittiness from both. I mean, it was just fucking remarkable. Like, this is what I mean. Like, it's a random Saturday. I don't even know how many people are watching this shit. There's probably a lot of MK fans who are like, oh, Luke's doing a post-fight show for this. Fuck that fight card. Skipped it, you know? Routine excellence, and if you can find the right wavelength to get it. And these two guys, I tweeted about it. These are the kind of fights. I haven't gotten to the specifics of it yet. We'll get into it. These are the kind of fights where you're just watching in the middle of it and you're like, fuck, man, I hope these guys are getting paid. You know? I don't know if anyone else is that way. If you are, you're like me. If not, I'm not, you know, I'm not judging. Everyone's their own way, you know? But that's just a natural thing that comes to my mind. I'm watching Giga Chikadze get hit with, you know, spinning back elbows in the fifth, landing with the sound. You know, I don't know what the medical diagnosis is, but it sounded like his face shattered when it landed. And you're just like, and he stands and stumbles and then, you know, is once more into the fucking breach. You know, you're just like, dude, what are they getting paid, man? What are they getting paid? I'm not going to make this a huge hallmark of today's review of the results. Don't worry, I will not be on a soapbox about it. But I'm leveling with the audience here. I'm watching this. I'm just going, fuck. I'm going to see if there's going to be, will there's in Nevada to even share payouts anymore? I guess they don't, but, you know, which is another problem with the Apex is obviously great in many respects because we get lots of MMA, but because Nevada has changed the rules, we actually get a lot less information than we once got. So if they were on the road and in California more, we would have more information about this, but, you know, I guess we'll see what happens. But anyway, sensational contest. And let's talk about Calvin Kattar. I said before, he's got Michael Bisping's spirit. To take a beating like that, and then, you know, that long trip home, and then you got to heal from everything that happened. And I'm sure, you know, he's going to heal probably better than a lot of us might. But nevertheless, that's just a lot of abuse, man. It's a ton, you know, and a stinging rebuke of the placement between you and by his own acknowledgement, the uncrowned king of the division. That's a lot to come back from psychologically, dude. People should not take that for granted. They should not. He makes it look like it's just fucking ordinary. It's like having a friend who could just walk over fire and not get burned. You'd be like, dude, everyone can do that shit. No. He can do that shit. You dumbasses cannot. Like, Calvin Kattar can do that shit. You dumbasses cannot. It's just the level of conviction, self-assuredness, appetite for brutality, frankly, is on another level. So how did he do it? As I meander around here, I'm just pointing out, like, you know, what the abuse that these guys tolerated, more so obviously Giga Chikadze tonight, but certainly, you know, what they are coming from, what he dished out tonight. People would take 1% of 1% of 1% of 1% of that and never show up at the gym again. You'll never see him again. And these guys just do the most elevated version of that. And, you know, it is utterly remarkable. Okay, so how did Calvin Kattar do it? Let me pull up the fight metric numbers while I situate myself. Let's see here. I should have had them up beforehand. Sorry about that, y'all. All right, so we will orient ourselves at the beginning of this discussion around the numbers here. So, how does it look? Okay, I'm assuming these are final. Again, the numbers on the broadcast are typically not great as a reliable indicator of the final numbers. So these are the final numbers. Obviously, a lot of grappling in the first round from Calvin Kattar. Dude, he right away, man, just setting the tone with intensity. Chikadze slips on a kick, and he didn't just go for the takedown, dude. He pursued that takedown with, you know, absolute overzealousness. And in that way, what I mean is, like, dogged determination to get it high elevation. Like, there was no way he was going to let that opportunity pass, and he didn't, and he secured it. It was remarkable. So not a lot of striking per se. There was a little bit of, you know, sort of minor work from Calvin Kattar, but we'll talk about the defensive grappling and the grappling overall in just a second. Second round, this is where, you know, it's sort of not quite. Second round, Chikadze landed more, 38 strikes to 28 strikes. It turns in the third numerically. This is not indicator of the qualitative difference, just numerical. 25 to 22, that's when Kattar takes the lead. Then round four was round five, 36 to 28 in round four, and then 51 to 32 in round five. Also, he is credited with a takedown. Calvin Kattar is in the first and the second, 2 of 7 overall with a control time of 3 minutes and 42 seconds. Great work from Calvin Kattar in just sort of positionally staying one step ahead of Chikadze on the mat, maintaining position, flowing with things, letting the other guy work through him a little bit harder as he kind of rolled through to stay dominant on top, making careful, good decisions about how to maintain, you know, not just a dominant position, but a dominant position where if you're going to really commit to it, you've committed to it because it's safe, it's fully properly secured, and if not, you know, making a little bit more careful choices about it, you know, navigating the choppy waters in that way expertly. And you know, Chikadze was constantly looking for some way around this, for some way through this. And Calvin Kattar, I think, you know, no one's control was perfect, but it was a strong start for him, in part because now Chikadze has been, you know, had to grapple for a round, right? Which is not like, you know, oh, now he's all of a sudden Superman without his powers. He is still quite formidable, but it is at least a little bit of work you have put them. It is a round you have put him through where it's not the front half of the second where you're going to feel it unless they're really out of shape, but you might start feeling it at the back half of the second sometimes, right? Sometimes that shows up, and sure enough, it did in this one too. I thought we did see some of that show up at the back half, but what Kattar did was essential about this, and we are essential to this. We talked about this on I talked about this on Friday's show/chat. I did not see a way plausibly. I mean, yes, theoretically, of course, but plausibly, I did not see a way for Kattar to win if it did not involve strictly backing up at all times. Giga Chikadze, right? It's the old Fedor versus Krokop game plan. If you're facing a lot of different kinds of opponents, but in this particular case, and in that one referentially from the historical note I'm making here, if you have someone that is sort of kicking dominant, Krokop, or in this case Giga Chikadze, really putting them on their heels makes life difficult for them. One that is exhausting, right, to constantly be backing up because they really need their space and their timing to set and throw, even though they can throw it efficiently and economically. Like, they don't need a ton of room, but they need some. And if you put them under a constant pressure, it becomes very difficult for them. So it's taxing to do that. And two, it just sort of offensively mutes them. And then they begin to have to trade strictly on hands. And that's when the problems begin to sort of right become visible. Between that and also you notice there was really patient footwork from both of them. Calvin Kattar doing a lot, not just sort of forward pressure, which was key, right? So he, under what conditions was he going to work? Behind the jab, one, and forward pressure. Those are the two ones that we talked about on Friday's show, and I think you saw a lot of that here. Now, it began to show that he needed a lot more after the jab got cooking, and they were just sort of openly trading. At that point, the jab doesn't lose its value, but it takes on a different role in that kind of environment and scenario. Still valuable, but differently valuable. Anyway, point being is that was one where Kattar was just going to win over time anyway. So you have this exhausting pressure. You have this pressure that takes away these weapons because you're inside of this kicking range. You have this offensively, you know, sort of muted scenario that this guy is under. And he just begins to work it over time. He would follow with the footwork where he would sometimes, some of it what he was doing to take away weapons. Obviously, they talked about switching stances to avoid getting hit with the giga kick to the liver. But there could be other reasons why he would switch from taking, you know, hard calf kicks, which, by the way, he got away from those because Kattar was really on him, on his putting him on his heels constantly. It's sort of like the old Edson Barboza approach, right? You know, Edson Barboza can be, you know, insanely formidable in the right circumstance, even against a great fighter opposite him. But, you know, it's just been shown that, like, you know, easier said than done, but a real pressure-based approach just it yields positive results, certainly more than any other game plan against him. It seems that at least for now, at this point in Giga Chikadze's journey, he is susceptible to the same kinds of things. Although, it should be noted, it's not like any bum off the street can just pull this off. That is in no way what I am suggesting. What I am suggesting, though, is remember, I think Kattar was sitting at 5 in the division in terms of ranking and Giga 8. And again, you can always quibble with the exact placement, but that does speak to a little bit of where they were. I agree that generally there is a little bit more seniority, and Kattar had done better work to be ranked to that point. I felt that that was appropriate. And you know, it was man, that was manifested here. I think you saw there was a bit of a difference there. And for him to do it off the heels of that kind of a beating is, man, whew. I just keep shaking my head because they make it look so, I just can never get over how routine they make it look, man. It's like a magic show, you know, like these are the magicians that actually do saw people in half, though. It's like, it's fucking wild. I apologize if I loudly swallowed on the microphone. I didn't mean to. Let's look at some of the targeting. Jesus Christ. Whew. Calvin Cater, 88% targeting to the head, just 9% to the body, 2% to the leg. There is a story about the way Calvin Cater fights and uses kicking, but it's not a significant, I think most would agree, it's not a significant component to the way he fights. It has a role, but it's a fairly minor one. By contrast, Giga Chikadze, as you could understand, going to the body, right, with the Giga kick and to the leg and everything else, 21%, but even that I would say is low relative to what he probably wanted. I bet he probably wanted, I don't know if he put a numerical threshold on it, but I'm guessing a little bit more than what he ultimately got, let's say. Went to the head 73%, and then of course, as you can imagine, most of the fight in terms of striking took place at distance versus the clinch and the ground. Man, what, and by the way, I should also note that Cater to end round five the way he did, you know, with this, I won't say last minute, but you know, this triumphant, emphatic declaration of, you know, basically victory, but without the stoppage in, you know, in official time in that fifth round, right, where, you know, Giga gets knocked down and the whole thing is almost kind of over, you know, before the time expires. I mean, that is such a, dude, good for Calvin Cater. This business is tough enough and bullshit enough and hard enough. And, dude, I mean, just look at the last 10 rounds of Calvin Cater's life. I mean, I knew, you know, well, these guys have to know that, like, this occupation carries significant health hazards and risks and difficulties and the like. But, like, you know, the last 10 rounds that Calvin Cater's had to fight have been just the most brutal World War I trench warfare slog, man. And you lose long stretches of it, and you win long stretches of it. But either way, dude, you come out with the fucking meat grinder on the other side, man. It's just... I apologize. I know there's going to be people, he's fucking sounding like a broken record. You're right. I am. I apologize. You're right. But I just... The routineness is, it's remarkable to witness. You wish it was compensated with the riches that it is owed, and you are humbled by the ability to watch something like that and share the joy, as well as some of the the apprehensions about it, along with it. It's a complicated joy. Fighting is a complicated joy, right? Is that not a fair and, you know, ultimately almost like nothing statement, but enough to be true. It's a complicated joy. It's an engrossing joy as well. Hence why we're here. So what can we say else about this? I did have another thought. It's something I've been sort of toying with for some time. If you've heard me, two more thoughts, actually. Well, actually, that one's about a different one. But this one. Calvin Cater and Max Holloway are very, very different fighters, right? Different in style and in many important respects. But there's a lot of things that unite them, too. These are guys who typically do their best and most work in boxing range. You just heard me describe the numbers of Calvin Cater and where he's sort of, I mean, headhunting in general, but, you know, you can sort of look at how many of those are kicks. It's not many, right? So this is a guy who does his work in a very similar kind of way in that respect. And what I've noted is, you know, another guy like this is Adrian Yanez, insanely talented, a delight to watch. Seems like a wonderful guy. same thing here. Calvin Kattar, I've interviewed him, seems like the nicest dude on planet Earth. But that style, it is, even on the winning end of things, man, it's a bit of a blood and gut style, man. You know, it's when you get guys like that, and they not only tend to they tend to be like the more cerebral versions of it, and you know, Yanez is quite bright, and Max Holloway quite bright, and Calvin Kattar quite bright. They tend to have this influencing role on the fight itself, right? They have this ability to, and then the best fighters do, to define the fight on their terms. Well, their terms are trading in these boxing ranges and angles and scenarios. And again, they get the best of it usually by a long shot. But nevertheless, it just involves being in a place where contact is not just going to be inevitable, but frankly, frequent. It will be frequent. You know, I don't know how long that style is. Of all the styles in MMA that keep you in it the longest, I would not put that one at the top of the list. It seems to me that you get some of our brightest and most talented A-plus fighters that I'm excited about, you're excited about, we're all excited about. I do question, yeah, again, all the shots are of, you know, questionable damage, certainly. Some are quite pronounced, obviously some are not, but nevertheless, it's just the amount of just traffic is overwhelming, I guess is what I would say. There's just a traffic of strikes that is, I think, I worry that it will cause problems. The other one was one of the other fights on the card. I think it was at the co-main. I don't even know if it was the co-main. No, it's not the co-main. I'll come back to that. I don't have a ton of thoughts about the Caitlin Chookagian and Jennifer Maia fight. Although Chookagian, it's a great win for her. These are, I think, top five fighters in their division. I don't have the rankings in front of me, but I think they're either there or pretty close to it. Certainly, they've both fought for the title, so we're talking about, you know, the preeminent side of the women's flyweight division. And Chookagian just was better overall, 30-27 across the board. Even in the grappling department, she was able to be the kind of one in control. A little like Maia wanted to do a little bit more, I won't say brawling, but a little bit more, you know, Chookagian was able to work at range when she had to, but it was also great in the grappling scenarios as well. But the thing that caught my attention was not really any of those things, even though we should acknowledge this is a great win by Chookagian, is that... And I'm sure someone else has said this before me. I don't in any way suggest that, like, I'm sure some of you have noticed this and probably tweeted about it and shared it. So I am no way am like, I made this grand discovery. That's not what I mean. But something occurred to me today, however late. The first wave in the modern era of wrestling best practices, like when people were like, oh, this is how you wrestle in MMA, when there was enough body of work, there was a teachable skill set that was pretty effective for most people in most fights, even at the UFC level, in that modern era, and in who was coming into the sport and influencing some of those things. A lot of collegiate wrestling, obviously, where there was some Olympic influence, but it was generally leg attacks. It was, I mean, of course, there are exceptions. Early on, there was the Raw team with Rico Ciparelli and Randy Couture, and then parts of that turned into Team Quest, and you had Matt Linlin, and a lot of those guys had the Greco background. Of course, Rulon Gardner even. There's always been a Greco influence. That's not what I'm suggesting. What I am saying is, in terms of the routine wrestling scenarios that you're seeing in MMA now, right, typically along the fence line, I'd have to go back and look and think about this a little bit more, but typically along the fence line, but there it's upper body wrestling. The first wave of best practices was all leg attacks, and you know, or predominantly leg attacks. This new wave is that, but I think because fence wrestling has become such a, like, dude, it's hard if someone stands in front of you, turns to the side, splits their base, and is good about like head pressure and like underhooking, dude. You know, unless you're Habib or some shit, you're not going to get him off the. You're not going to get him down. It's not going to go for you. You know, no, it's not going to work. So what are you going to do? Like, there's a, but like upper body clinching, it turns out that actually can be pretty powerful, in part because we've talked about this, locked hands. There was another fight. We'll talk about that one too. The was it the Bonterin and Brandon Royval fight? I mean, part of the reason that we got kind of close to was Bonterin. You know, you can question what he was doing with it from a punishment standpoint, but he's got locked hands. You know, with these locked hand scenarios, man, you could just ride him out for long periods of time. And anyway, you get the idea. I'm just sort of pointing out that I don't know where the fuck I lost my train of thought. It doesn't matter. Who gives a shit? It's 10:38 on a Saturday night, and I'm drinking water. I forget where I was going with this. Doesn't really matter. Okay. Jake Collier versus Chase Sherman. You know, people want to hate on Jake Collier and fat shame the guy. Looks to me like he's got, I mean, you know, listen, is this the most optimal condition to be in athletically for his career prospects? It certainly doesn't, this doesn't seem likely, but he certainly looked great tonight, right? He looked great. You don't want to deny that. His hands look good. Forward pressure was overwhelming. He had Chase Sherman on the back foot. This is just sort of another scenario where the same kind of thing went in there. And, you know, the grappling was good too. Like, there was a clear difference in the grappling. Like, Chase Sherman was, you know, you could see him pressing, and then his like half guard just comes wide open as he's pressing, because he's not wrestling in that moment anyway. Like, again, this is not in any way suggesting I or you could do better, just watching what happens. Like, just think about it, man. If someone passes your guard, you failed to do something correctly. Someone takes your back, you failed to do something correctly. So you had the just vicious ground and pound, because he had moved to mount, and he moved to mount effortlessly. He put pressure right on top of him. You see Sherman essentially pin himself underneath when his guard gets put like that, and then Collier just uses that pressure on top to just ride essentially into three-quarter mount and then full mount, and then he just absolutely hammered him through the canvas after that. He turned over, and then he got the tap. It's great work for a co-main event between two guys at heavyweight who, you know, are not at the top of the division. That's a best-case scenario. Fans should be grateful to Jake Collier. So, you know, yeah, good for him. Great win. Brandon Royval defeating Rogério Bonterin. We talked about this a little bit. There's a controversy in the third about the tapping. Did he tap? There's two competing theories, basically. In real time, I thought he did. Okay. Upon review, I'm less certain, but leaning towards that. I asked people to make an argument to me about which way they felt about it. Did he tap, did he not, to the armbar? And people were split. There were sensible arguments that were given to me from either side. And by the way, it should be noted, many of the people who say he did tap were in the black belt / training, officiating crew side of things, right? So these are not, you know, amateurs or something like that. That doesn't mean that they automatically get, like, well, we just defer to them. But, you know, these are not people who are unaccustomed to watching this kind of stuff. And the two arguments are, one is, did he remove his hand from being trapped to tap and then regret it once there was a slightly different feeling? Perhaps that is one theory. The other theory is that he removed it, and then in the process, he kind of like flailed. And in flailing, it looked like tapping. It does look like it, but that's not actually what it is. You know, you be the judge. I'd have to go back and look at it again. I've only seen it, you know, when it happened live, and then a handful of replay times. You know, it's... Can I say, perhaps you are different, can I conclusively say he was tapping? Like, because here's part of what the situation is. When people say, oh, he tapped, he didn't tap, what are we saying? Like, if we're saying he's tapping, tapping has to mean something. Now, I understand, like, there's a sort of colloquial way of describing it. Oh, it's this right here, right? And we all kind of know it when we see it. But here's a clear-cut case where some kind of clearly defined parameters for helping us understand what we're looking at and what is defined as a surrender. And I guess some states probably, by the way, have this. It should be noted. But that's all that matters when we say, did he tap? So I'll tell you what I'm looking for. One could be, you know, a clear signal that someone is surrendering, right? A very aggressive tap, let's say, on the ground sometimes. For example, Chase Sherman tapped to the floor. He didn't tap to the hands of his opponent. But what you're really looking for me, is intentionality. Because he tapped once, or again, either on purpose or not, there was one tap. People were like, oh, there has to be three for it to be a tap, but that's not really true. Like Sonnen versus Silva, Fedor versus Verdum, these are clear one-tap cases. Sonnen versus, was it Filio? No, Sonnen versus, was it Filio the first time?
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Some shit like that. Who was that to? I can't remember at this point. Anyway, you get the idea. It does happen. It is rare, but it's not. And it's certainly rare in jiu-jitsu tournaments. Like when you do see tapping there, it's like very direct. So it's like, if you watch tapping at the black belt level, you know, it's kind of funny, right? Because sometimes people get it and it's, you know, so this really kind of painful, like estima lock, you know, where you have to tap immediately to relieve this unbearable fucking pain. Or when, what was her face? When it was Tammy Musumeci got her fucking arm barred all the way behind her own back, you know, shit like that. But usually what you see is a very calculated surrender, like checkmate in chess, you know, where you've seen two fucking grandmasters and one guy just goes boop. It's tapping the same way. It's like they know when certain conditions are in place that the jig is up, and they just, you know, very matter-of-factly and directly, like, and it's all calm, you know. There's obviously a lot of exceptions to that rule, but there's a lot of that happens. Anyway, where the fuck am I going with this? Did he tap? It looked like that in real time. I don't know. You be the judge. It didn't matter in the end. Brandon Royval got his hand raised. He deserved to get his hand raised. He, I thought, was really good about keeping his sensible defense underneath. He was very good about always framing, creating frames and separation underneath. He got to his feet, you know, not effortlessly, certainly, but it was never not part of the action he was putting together, unless he had some kind of really dominant grappling position, which certainly at the end he did. Great show by him. I think he was saying he wanted to come in and show a little bit of patience, and I think that's exactly what he showed. Split decision, by the way, here, 29-28, 28-29, 29-28. But that was a very, you know, did he show like brand new skills he never had before? No. But did he show a kind of competitive strategic application of them that yielded better results, or it certainly yielded the kind of results he wanted under significant duress from a very talented opponent? Yes. Yes, that's very much important and something. Anyway, I think I got lost somewhere talking about Chookagian and Maya, but Greco-Roman wrestling appears to be much more important in modern MMA than it ever has been. Santa? What's he call himself? Santoslav? Is that what he calls himself? Vyacheslav Borshev hits a fucking rib-roasting liver shot to Dakota Bush, puts him down, 347 of the very first round, does a dance. I don't know what it's called, but it was spectacular. Just crown this man already. Whereas, I mean, forget about giving this guy a post-fight bonus, although certainly he is entitled to one. Is there a crown that they could give as well that he could walk around with, unironically? Because he has earned it. What a fantastic performance. What a memorable... What a way to stick out on a broadcast is what I would say. And look good doing it. Look sensational. Dakota Bush did not lay down, prior to getting his liver deformed. You know, he was making it as competitive as possible. He was certainly, trying. Great win. Bill Algeo defeating Joe. I didn't even know how to say this guy's name. I was like, what is it? Joe Anderson Brito, 30-27, 29-28, and I'm sure I'm saying Brito wrong. 29-28. Bill Algeo is scrappy as shit, man. That dude is scrappy. What was this, his fourth UFC fight? I remember the first time he fought, let's see, it was, not the Contender Series one. By the way, you know who he fought against was Brandon Lochnan. He lost to Brandon Lochnan on the Contender Series. Dude, Brandon Lochnan's a good-ass fighter. Like, that's the guy that, no one ever talks about that. Everyone's always like, the trivia question is always, oh, who was the fighter that, won on the Contender Series but didn't because he went for a takedown at the last second? Brendan Lochnan. But no one ever asked, right, but who's the motherfucker who he beat? Dude, it was Bill Algeo. Bill Algeo is a good fighter. He's a really good fighter. Anyway, he made his debut against Ricardo Lamas, but I remember he was scrappy as shit. Then he put a beating on Spike Carlisle. Ricardo Lamas is tough, and he got overwhelmed in that one, but he rebounded on this one, and Brito kind of took the fight to him in spots, backing him up. But overall, here's another guy using great grappling, great use of the locked hands, making a strategic application out of it. It's just very, very hard to break. And if people don't know how to break it and the guy using it really knows how to off-balance an opponent and redirect them and move them into, takedown territories if that's what they want, or into big strikes, or just, and mentally kind of leaning on them. Dude, it's a brutal, awful place to be. And he had some of that going for him here, among other skills as well. It was a nice, well-rounded performance. He made it quite memorable at the end, saying he wanted to fight Giga Chikadze, which, by the way, Giga losing perhaps makes that more likely. I don't think they'll make that fight, but perhaps they might. One never knows. But accusing Giga Chikadze of being a Biden voter, which I thought was like, that's a very, yes, I am watching MMA. Yes, I am. God bless it, right? Long may she last. Hold on. But that's a very MMA moment. But he looked great. Give him his flowers. He looked great. He is constantly. Spike Carlisle was an overmatched opponent, because he's certainly a physically tough and wild, and that's its own kind of challenge. But Bill Algeo, to me, has shown great well-roundedness. Can really, this guy can be in gritty, long, drawn out, complicated, difficult grappling / wrestling / where you're just getting beat up every which way kind of scenarios. And he does them for long periods. He does them on the feet too, where he's constantly pressing into opponents. Dude, he's a tough guy. That was a solid win. And hey, memorable call out. Gotta give him credit. From the prelim card, Jamie Pickett defeating Joseph Holmes. The prelim card wasn't a lot of fun, I'll be honest. Court McGee got a nice win over Ramiz Abrahima, I think, as I say. Brian Kelleher looked pretty good against late replacement Kevin Kroom, who looked huge, by the way. And then TJ Brown got a nice win over Charles Rosa as well. There you have it. First one's in the books. All right, let me take a look at some of these questions that you lot have, and then we will call it a day. All right. Do you think Cater and his team learned from the pressure Max put on him and, to a degree, tried to replicate it when building a game plan for Giga? Perhaps. I would have to ask, certainly. But I think strategically it wasn't necessarily... Listen, that's not like... we talked about it on Friday. I brought it up on the show. It's not some grand insight, right? It's just... I won't call it obvious, but... It's just hard to imagine a counter-striking scenario against a forward-moving Giga Chikadze that's going to yield you better results than a difficult early start to backing him up, but one which, once you break through, yields significantly good results, right? It's just a more rational game plan. And so I think they rationally knew that was what was on the table for them, to the extent that getting backed up in that way reinforced how powerful that could be. Or perhaps he did learn some technical lessons from that. And also, you know, ways a retreating opponent could survive, right? Because he had to go through so many different scenarios where he learned what worked and what didn't. There's no denying an experience like that could be potentially invaluable, if assuming they're not mentally scarred by it. But I would also just caution that, like, that was the rational insight. The question is not that. The question is, what do you do technically and tactically to pull that off? And I think it needs to be said, Calvin Kattar's footwork tonight was just excellent. Consistently excellent footwork. It was very, there's a few times, hey, a 25-minute fight's going to happen. A few times he's out of position. A lot of times, man, he's right where he needs to be. He's doing excellent work, dude. And he's intercepting Giga Chikadze. He's steering him. You know, he was doing really good work in that way. Why did so many people assume Kattar was going to lose to Giga just because Max crushed him? The reason why is because a lot of times, I don't think this is a bad question. Actually, I think it's a really important question. Why do people like me harp on that? Okay. The reason why people like me harp on that is you got to be careful about just being an MMA fan is difficult, man. It's actually difficult. One, you get charged to the nth degree. But two, you get asked to look at these fighters as these vessels of entertainment. And, you know, over time, if you have this, if you become unmoored from the community, if you're not part of the community, if you're unmoored from it, or you consume it at this almost like distant way, you know, I think people can lose sight a little bit about, understandably, I'm not making a moral judgment here. That's not what I'm saying. But I think at times, if you haven't seen it up close a lot, I just don't think you realize what the toll that these guys, it's slow motion maiming. It's slow motion maiming. You know, it's like the worst bear attack spread over 15 years you've ever seen or something like that, right? You know, and so each part, you see it incrementally build, and these come at a cost. These guys, I started the show with it. Here I am repeating it again. They make it look like this is a thing that, like, if you just really try hard, you can get over it. No, dude, these guys are fucking psychotically competitive in ways that the average person off the street cannot even remotely comprehend. They just make it look effortless. And I really, if I say nothing else, I hope that people really understand that, truly appreciate that. When you see a beating like what he took against Max, I understand why some people may not necessarily have that instinct to be like, well, you know, it was a bad beating, but, you know, he's young or whatever. That's a fair point as well. And it certainly turned out to be truer than any kind of panic about the immediate negative results it would have. But I think as well, as just a general posture, if you see someone lose in a 5-round fight, and in this particular case, you're like, oh, well, what's the dividing line between when we're concerned and when we're not? Well, how about one that's historically the most significant, at least quantitative, beating we've ever seen? You know, or just go look at the tape. I mean, don't you remember there was controversy about when that fight should have been stopped? I think as early as the 3rd round. And, you know, so again, and there was debate at the time. Not everyone thought it was a fight that should have been stopped. So that should be clear as well. But just pointing out, it was a really bad beating. And I think, man, I've just seen, dude, it's Teddy Atlas has said it. Every time these guys go do this, they are giving a part of themselves to this thing. They come out a little bit less. You know, and it sounds dramatic and, like, you know, almost hokey and maybe like poetic or something, but it's not true in the literal sense, I suppose, or in some ways even that is true, but certainly it's a good way to describe the nature of their sacrifice. Dude, like, they come out of these things, man, and it's a, you know, it's the worst car crash you've ever seen over the course of however long their career is. You know, it's like, That's if you added up all the injuries they got, and then someone survived that in a car crash, they'd be on the. There would be like a news special about them on 60 Minutes. You know what I mean? It's like, oh, torn both ACLs, broken femur, you know, punctured lung, God knows how many lacerations and twisted ankles, and you know, and now they're getting towards 40. They need a hip replacement and neck and back issues and nerve damage, right? Someone survived all of that in a car crash. You'd be like, God damn, dude, God, you know, I don't know what message he's trying to send, but he's definitely trying to keep you around for now. You know, so yeah, I just think you got to put yourself to the extent you can. You just got to really try to be as, you got to see the humanity in these guys as much as you possibly can. And that's why the last thing I'll say on the fighter pay stuff is that's why the fighter pay stuff matters to me. It's not that the fighter pay makes up for it ultimately. Ultimately, it's still, I think, a kind of trade where the house, which is not the fighter, still wins and always wins, at least metaphorically. But I think it's the closest you can get to morally absolving yourself for liking it. Right, is making sure that the people doing it get the kind of compensation that they're entitled to. That's my belief, basically, in a nutshell. Like, if you're asking, why do I cover fighter pay with perhaps the fervor that I do relative to other issues, it's because I just think the unique nature of what they do can only be rewarded by the maximization of pay. That in a nutshell is sort of what I believe, basically. I mean, there's a broader defense to it, but that is the basic idea. That's the gist. All right, there's a whole fucking bunch of more of these. Hang on. Best way to nullify forward pressure like Cater display tonight, other than clinching. Well, certainly you could have a retreating game plan. Carlos Condit used a retreating game plan against Nick Diaz. It's not like a retreating game plan ultimately fails. It's just taxing and difficult, and it reduces you. You know, there's a lot of ways to it. Yes, there's footwork ways to absorb pressure, take angles, but you know, in some way, you just have to kind of you could sort of fight fire with fire, but. For any kind of issue like this, there's always going to be it's just a terrible answer, but the long story short is, you know, what is the best way? The best way depends on what the skill set is of the fighter and what the challenge calls for, what they can reasonably be asked to pull off. And that sounds a little bit unfair of an answer, but that's really the truth. So you know, here in this case is, what would have been the best way for Giga Chikadze in this case against Calvin Kattar? If he could have found a way to really lead, I think, with the calf kicks, offensively wrestling, I thought may have been on the table as well, but that would not have worked. So here again, so the question is not what could someone theoretically do. What did Max Holloway do to take away the forward pressure of Calvin Kattar? Right, Calvin Kattar wasn't trying to put as much forward pressure on him, but he tried a lot. Max Holloway and his team noticed that when you have Calvin Kattar starting out, he's jabbing. He's got good footwork. He's setting things up. He's faking. He's feinting. He's moving. But if you throw back, he'll just cover and move away. So what they realized was, okay, soon as he throws, we're going to let him throw. And then as soon as he throws, we're going to bait him to throw, whatever. As soon as he throws, whatever reason, either we baited it or he did it, we're going to then basically just blitz him with four or five punch combinations. We're going to pressure into him. We're going to mix up high, low, left, right, body, head, right? Because he's just going to cover up like this. He doesn't, like Jose Aldo, what does Jose Aldo do? Jose Aldo is going to slip and then come back and then throw. Now, Max had a different answer for that problem, but, you know, you get the idea. So he's not offering that kind of defense. He's not offering that kind of pull. Anyway. I forgot where I was even going with this fucking answer. Jesus, I'm off my game tonight. I'm tired. the answer is to this. Where was I even going with this? Mm. So disappointing. I'm so sorry about that. I did not take notes today. I took notes the last time. I did not take notes today, and now I am regretting it because there's a bunch of shit I wanted to say. Fuck it. I will come back to it. I apologize to the audience. All right. The elbows on the kickboxers seem to be one of the more underrated strategies versus crossover kickboxers. That's interesting. I don't know. I would say Cater's always been a pretty clever boxer and a very surprisingly clever striker, too, more than just that. He's had the elbow in the Stevenson fight, right? Or Jeremy Stevens, excuse me, not Stevenson, Jeremy Stevens. He had the elbow in that fight, and where else did he have the elbow? Not sure where else, but... Carlos Condit had it against Thiago Alves. That's another good one. How good is Max? Yeah, Max is fucking good. But that was his answer to the forward pressure. So to answer the forward pressure question once and for all, the answer is... lots of different ways. There's lots of different ways to do it, but it really kind of depends on the specific blueprint of what you have as a fighter in front of you and what reasonably they can be asked to do given what they're good at against a specific task by the time they get to the UFC. Even after this incredible comeback performance from Cater, do you see him beating Holloway or Volkanovski? Not yet, but dude, as a rebound, you can't ask for more than that this time. Maybe next time. In subsequent fights, but to do what he did after what happened to him, amazing. How much of an impact was that first round takedown? Huge, I think. What are the chances of seeing Volk and Max 5 to 6 times? That's a little much. How much more impressive does this make what Holloway did? Yeah, again, dude, Holloway is... Pretty special, dude. He's very, very good. And I, this is the other part about Holloway. It's like, everyone's like, oh, he's skilled as a boxer and whatnot. Dude, I keep going back to this. His team, Eugene Behrman himself has told me multiple times on the record, it should be noted, him and his team might be the best strategists in the game. Certainly some of the very best. At the, you know, top of the fucking food chain level of ability. Dude, those guys are clever. You ever notice they don't do any interviews? They don't talk about shit over there, man. I used to try to ask those guys on there. Shouts to them. They're great guys. I get it, man. They're not trying to, you know, they're trying to do their thing. I used to try to get those guys on, and every time I get them on, man, they were nice as shit, and they're very friendly and they're gracious with their time, but they would never tell me a thing. They might tell me some of the stuff about their theory on fighting, but they would never spill the beans. But, dude, they're very clever. They're very clever, smart people. And so you've got a guy like Max who's got all this ability, who's got all that fighting mojo and spirit, and he's got a team that comes up with a game plan that is, you know, a lot of you think was a winning game plan for his two fights with Volkanovski at a bare minimum, but has put him exceedingly close. And Volkanovski is another one who's got top of the food chain, people behind him. So, you know, you're talking about guys who have the bases covered as fighters in ways that, you know, even most other pro fighters couldn't even imagine. Was Giga looking past Cater? No, I don't think so at all. What a bigger surprise. Giga unable to adjust his game plan or Cater's ability to absorb the Giga punishment? What's a bigger surprise? For me, I guess I should not have been this way. I was wrong. But I'll say for me, the bigger surprise was Cater being like walking into a lot of punishment to pull that off. That's a hard game plan to pull off. Like, you know what it is, man. Dude, sometimes battle plans are very sophisticated. People think like the more sophisticated it is, like the more dangerous and like high level. But dude, sometimes that's not really what the challenge is about. Sometimes the challenge is like, it's not complex what we have to do strategically. It's just going to be brutal. It's just going to be brutal. There's really no other way to do this. There is no, I can smart my way around the punishment and difficulty of this all. No, you cannot. You just have to have a hard, difficult slog. You know, and that's the reality. All right, I'm not going to get to that one. Some of these questions are a little bit unfair. Cater Ortega next. Whoo. I hadn't thought of it. I should have thought of it. Man, that's a great fight. That's a great, golly, dude. They put an Ortega through the meat grinder. Whoo, man. That division. These guys are absolutely... I keep saying it, but it's so true, man. It's like, oh, here's your reward, Brian Ortega. I mean, and he's talented as shit, too. He'll put a beating on Calvin. Dude, here's what I know about Brian Ortega. Win or lose, he's going to put a beating on Calvin Kattar. You know what I mean? Like, that's just what it's going to be. Golly, man. These guys, it's just brutal. It's brutal. So it says Calvin's boxing didn't seem as sharp tonight. He was much more interested in a game of kind of speed chess than chess. He did have some nice boxing. I thought he had some uppercuts that adjusted some of the kind of like leaning pressure that was showing. He did a good job, I thought. But dude, a lot of what he was doing again was chasing Giga. A lot of it was angling Giga and forcing him to just move and constantly in this sort of state of tension. A lot of it was, you know, pressuring through. So it wasn't designed to yield like the prettiest boxing in that way. And again, just a very difficult game plan, a very simple game plan, but an insanely difficult one. I mean, there was more to it with the way in which he approached and he was setting angles. Like, I don't want to say that there was no thought process to it. Please don't misunderstand me, but you get the idea. Part of it was like, you're just going to get hit a lot by Giga and you have to accept that. And he did. He accepted it fully and it worked. That's impressive. I figured the high guard of Kattar would leave him ripe to the body for the taking. When Giga stopped kicking, did he seal his fate? Yeah. But I think part of the reason why he stopped kicking was because he just could never set his feet under constant duress. All right, well, I apologize for all the times that I meandered into a state of nothingness. Surely that is worthy of being lampooned, and I'm sure that I will. But I want to thank you guys for watching. Like the video. Hit subscribe. If you have an email for me, you can shoot me an email, lukethomasnews@gmail.com. I try to respond to everyone. I don't always get the opportunity to do that, but right now is a good time. So there you go. All right. Love ya. Let's see. No show on Monday, but Monday resume review will be out, which is going to be great. And then Tuesday we have another video for you that you're going to love. That's going to set the tone for UFC 270 fight week, basically. Well, also resume review might do that as well. I guess we'll see, but you get the idea. So Monday and Tuesday, fresh content headed your way. Yeah, should be a good time. Thank you so much for spending some time with me tonight. Again, apologies for meandering. Should have taken some notes. I did it last time. I forgot this time. I will not make that mistake again. So I appreciate you sticking with me. I hope you enjoyed the fights. Hope you enjoyed watching this. Until next time, get some sleep. Bye, all.